Having Sage-approved audio for our car rides is a literal lifesaver for my nervous system, and I love making lists of podcasts to share with him when he's ready. I was so excited to hear about a new show called Mysteries About True Histories, affectionately known as MATH, MATH, geared toward the 6+ crowd. Every episode follows two best friends, Max and Molly, who work together to solve riddles and math equations during their time-traveling adventures. Episodes drop every Thursday and are about 15 minutes long, the perfect length for car rides and mealtimes, and stacked with so much laughter that your kiddos won't even realize how much they're learning. So tune in to Mysteries About True Histories with your kids. You can follow and listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your pods. Y'all, I am so jazzed to share today's special episode with you. It's a sneak peek from our 2024 SEED Teacher Summit coming at you March 12th to the 14th. We are so grateful to have a brand new batch of incredible speakers this year and so many essential topics like playful transitions, why play matters for neurodivergent learners, and of course, how to manage a classroom full of spitters. This is going to be a compilation episode with little snippets from a handful of the interviews just to give you a taste of what's to come. The summit is free, F-R-E-E, free, to watch, so please share it with any educators, administrators, or fellow caregivers in your life who would benefit from learning more about supporting teachers and kids with the resources they need to thrive. We are all in this thing together, and it fills my cup to be able to hand over high-quality professional development and learning opportunities completely for free. Head on over to seedandsow.org/summit to register. That's seedandsow.org/summit. All right, folks, let's dive in.
Hey there, I'm Alyssa Blass Campbell. I'm a mom with a master's degree in early childhood education and co-creator of the Collaborative Emotion Processing Method. I'm here to walk alongside you through the messy, vulnerable parts of being humans raising other humans, with deep thoughts and actionable tips. Let's dive in together.
First, we are hearing from Finn Menzies, parent coach and consultant who started his career as an educator and co-founded Q Inclusion. Finn will be sharing about balancing boundaries, navigating accountability with team members and caregivers.
So I think that we often get sucked into thinking about our students instead of ourselves. And so we always have this like new energy to get in the classroom and set it up and make it so beautiful and check our rosters and learn about them. But I think what we forget is that teaching, although it feels like we're siloed or on an island, we're always teaching in community, whether we're on a grade level team or we're working with other professionals, like maybe in special ed or even parents, right? And other caregivers. So I think that we really, like you said, like we miss the opportunity to really forefront these relationships so that they stay healthy, that the joints of these relationships stay like lubricated so that we can model that for our students. Because I was like going over all the research actually. So the most important thing in a child's learning experience is their home life and their parents. The next thing is teacher's role and classroom culture.
That makes sense.
And so how do we forget that like the way that we commune and speak to each other is so important to the class culture? So my proposition for teams is that while they're in that exciting new August, September energy, that they sit down and they go over the things that you mentioned. So, and it's kind of tricky because it takes vulnerability to do that.
Totally. You know? I think also like, how do you find out what your communication style is, right? Like, how do you know? Just the other day, my husband said to me, you hate when people talk to you as if you don't know that thing already, even if you don't know that thing already. And I was like, yeah, when they're condescending. And he was like, right, but like the way that you perceive certain things is as condescending, and the way that he perceives that same thing isn't condescending. And I was like, ooh, yep. Let me sit with that. But it was like news to me of like, yeah, for me, I was like, duh, everybody hates that. And he was like, I don't, like, that doesn't bother me.
Okay, this is a great place to start, right? Is to ask, like, does it feel good to have explicit instruction, or does it feel good to have a curiosity question with your team members? So you could ask them that. I usually start by modeling. I do not like, I'm a very temperamental Aries. And I really also don't like hurting people's feelings. So those things are tricky for me. So I like written responses better.
So is my husband.
Yeah. So it gives me time. So I usually begin the year by saying, if you have something tricky to tell me, will you write it to me, either leave it on the desk or put it in an email so that I can take my time to respond? And don't take my time as avoidance. I'm really marinating on that. And so when I like offer that, then you might get some juices flowing from your teammates saying, like, actually, emails feel weird and awkward to me. Like, I'd rather just have a tap on the shoulder.
That I love that. And like, that makes sense. I love that example because I'm a human who, like, if I get the email, I'm like, no, I want to talk about it right now. I'm an auditory processor in so many ways. Like, talking through things is how I move through them. And I have had to learn in different relationships who can handle that and who can't, right? So for instance, with my husband, that's not how he works through stuff. He is like you. He loves something written. He likes time and space to process. And then when he's coming to the table, it actually isn't beneficial for us if I'm doing my processing then with him at that point. And so we kind of struck up a deal where I was like, all right, I need to be able to turn to one of these, like, kind of few people in my circle to process stuff with if it is in relationship to you, so that when I come back to you, I can navigate this conflict in a productive way. And that was vulnerable on his end too, to say, like, yeah, you can talk about this thing with other people. That's about me.
Right. Okay. And like, that's like maybe your most intimate relationship. And now we're talking about like working relationships.
Yeah.
And how tricky that might be. But that's what I mean though, because all of these things are happening anyway, whether we want to look at them or not, these dynamics are happening. And so I do think making a contract of like, I am an audio processor. Like, I am somebody who needs to bounce back ideas. Like, who am I going to do that with? Or what signal can I say? Like, do you have capacity to do it now? Because we know as educators that when we remove the cognitive load that is surrounding academics, like if kids know that they belong, right? If they feel safe, if they're well fed, then they can attend. Well, it's the same for us. Like, if we're feeling threatened because somebody's blabbering on and we're like, I'm not ready, you know, then we can't really attend to what they need from us. So I'm asking teaching teams to be more intentional about that.
Our next speaker is Jasmine Bradshaw, anti-racist educator, educational consultant, podcaster, and founder of First Name Basis. She'll be sharing about bringing anti-bias, anti-racism practices to every classroom.
We need to start with ourselves being the grown-ups, because I think that that is such a temptation, is to be like, okay, how do we teach the kids? Which obviously is so important. But if we are not in the room and in the work, in the movement, then we won't be ready to have those conversations. And so I always like to think about the example of after Brown versus the Board of Education, the Supreme Court decision that integrated schools. And we look at the way that the country really went about that, right? There was no guidelines. They would just said integrate schools. There was no framework for how to do it. And the white segregationists in the South really still wanted to control the education system. And so they decided, instead of taking the strengths from both of the schooling systems and taking the talent from both of the schooling systems, they said, we're going to leave the Black teachers out of it and we'll just integrate the students. And we saw, I mean, you've seen the pictures and the videos, and we know the stories of Ruby Bridges, right? We know what happened to those Black children who had to go into white schools by themselves, and the trauma that they experienced, and the trauma to the community at large. Everyone is hurt by racism, right? And from the 50s to 70s, there were 100,000 Black teachers who were pushed out of education, whether they were fired or demoted. And so we could see what happens when we don't start with the grownups. When the grownups aren't willing to do what we're asking children to do, it causes harm for everyone. So I like to encourage people to think about what is your place in the movement? What is something that you're really passionate about? I mean, I imagine if you're here and you're watching or listening to this, then you are passionate about teaching young kids like I am. But I had a college professor say one time, think about what makes you the most mad, and that's the problem that you're meant to solve. It sounds a little like sad, but he was like, what gets you the most fired up? And racism really touches every aspect of our lives, from education to healthcare to finances. So wherever you are, whatever you're doing, there's something anti-racist that you can be doing to push this work forward.
I'm thinking about bell hooks. Thank you for bringing her in. I'm thinking about Teaching to Transgress. I don't think it's a book that a lot of people know about her work, but this book specifically touches on the role of the teachers, and she's speaking from a higher education perspective. She was a professor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but I've used her work in this book to really dive deep into my own practice in regards to what does it mean for me to be the one as the adult to be responsible for learning how to be in relationship with other adults, learning about my biases, learning about the stereotypes of other people that don't look like me.
Yeah.
And not putting the labor on the oppressed, but more so me doing my work to be able to facilitate space. And like, what does that look like in classrooms with young children? And I think that starting off with yourself as the adult is a really important piece, because if you don't know, I think that it's really inequitable to ask young children, and this comes from bell hooks's book, ask young children to do work and then us as the adults be like, well, you teach us more about how to do this. Like, you help me solve my emotions. You help me figure out this. You keep your body calm and safe and
yes,
do all of that work while I sit over here in my comfort. And that's not the role of the adult or the teachers in here. So thank you for putting us to do the work, calling us out to do our work.
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the things too that it brought to mind when you talked about bell hooks was just the model that she was. Mm. I mean, especially in this work, but I also think about like when I was teaching, I used to be a second grade teacher, and I would have people come in, parents would come in for their conferences, and they would say, oh my goodness, like I really want my kiddo to read more. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, that's great, because second grade is a really pivotal year, and third grade is when they start reading to learn versus learning to read. And so they really got to get their skills down. And they would say, how do I get my kiddos to read more? And I was like, let me look into that. So I did some research. I found this New York Times article that it was a long article that basically said, if you want your kids to read, you have to read. And I was like, duh. And it had a line in there that said, if you want to raise a reader, you need to be a reader. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that applies to so much. And I just thought, well, if you want to raise an activist, you got to be an activist. It's so simple. And we try to complicate it way more than it needs to be.
It's so frustrating to spend the money and effort to buy your kids clothes just to have them grow out of the size within a week, or have your kids complain that they itch, pinch, or just aren't comfortable. If you're with me on this, you've got to check out Posh Peanut. Their sensitive, skin-friendly clothes are made from viscose, from bamboo, stretch with your kid as they grow, and they're also made to last. Posh Peanut makes thoughtfully crafted, super cute clothing for kids and families. It is the softest thing, y'all. The design is all done in-house with different patterns, and it came in the mail and I was like, oh my gosh, I want to wear this for myself every day. Their luxe women's pajamas and robes were all that I wanted to wear postpartum for nursing and hanging out on the couch with Mila. It helps so much that the fabric is breathable and chemical-free, which means they're delicate against Mila's sensitive skin too. And I totally get why Posh Peanut is loved by over 1 million parents. Right now, Posh Peanut is offering our listeners 20% off your first order with promo code VILLAGE. Go to poshpeanut.com/VILLAGE and use promo code VILLAGE for 20% off your first order. That's poshpeanut.com/VILLAGE, promo code VILLAGE. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Being back to work after maternity leave has been so good and frankly, so hard. I love what I do and I missed collaborating with my team while I was out, and it's been a tough transition. The combination of a packed schedule and still being the milk machine for Mila Bean, it's hard to juggle everything. I feel so grateful for my weekly therapy hour. Sometimes I'm just holding so much and I need a safe space to let it out and get it off my chest. I've noticed that when I don't release it, it comes out anyway, but usually in ways that aren't aligned with how I want to show up in the world. BetterHelp is such a convenient, flexible option for parents who just can't take the travel time to get to an in-person therapy visit. It's entirely online. You can show up in your jammies, always a win in my book, and you can switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and you're on your way to feeling heard. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/voices today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/voices. Next up is Susie Allison from Busy Toddler, a former teacher with a master's in early childhood education and mom to three kids, talking about how to support kindergarten readiness.
I would love if educators, we could start to reframe, is this idea, we continue to call it kindergarten readiness, and we become so forward focused on kindergarten and how the child will be at kindergarten that we then forget that this is about an entire span of their education career. And we become so narrowly focused on kindergarten, which has, because it has at this point where we're at specific goals and specific standards, then we start to see kindergarten as this finite end position. And well, if we can just get the child to meet those goals that are written down on paper, that somehow that will translate to making the child, you know, smart or academic for the longevity of the next 15 years of their schooling career. And that's so short-sighted. And I think if we could shift and start talking about it as being school ready or life ready, that that's what we're trying to do with these kids. And that's the opportunity that we have in early childhood education, is to say, kindergarten is the next grade level we're going to be in, and then first, and then second, and then third, and then fourth. And if in preschool, they haven't learned that I can fail and keep going, or I can ask questions to learn more information, or I can just work on this for a while and I don't have to immediately come up with an answer. That's stuff that's going to carry beyond kindergarten and into all of those grades. And if we look at it just as ourselves as a teacher, we get more bang for our buck, because then our teaching is going to carry with that child so much farther than just if we focus solely on these very easy to memorize kind of academics that, again, look good on paper, but ultimately fall short of setting the child up for not only kindergarten, but then beyond kindergarten. And I think it's that beyond kindergarten, when we stop it at just kindergarten, say, well, we're making them kindergarten ready, I think we do a disservice to the child. And I think we do a disservice to the first grade teachers and the second grade teachers and the third grade teachers, because they also need this child to have learned these skills. And these skills often are best and easiest to learn in the 3s, 4s, and 5s.
I love this so much. I love the shift to life ready. And actually, I would like that to be like all of school's rebrand.
Yes.
Just like full rebrand. We're going for life ready.
Life ready.
Because that's what we're trying to do, right? Like, yes, help support these kids with tools for life, not to pass the test. And I was a human who am a human who, like, I can slay the test. Yeah. I'm not going to retain the information, but I can slay the test. Now, if I get to learn it for life readiness, yeah, I'll retain the information.
Yeah. 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 And I just think that that becomes so important. And it's, like I said, we're going to get more for our buck if we could focus, because you're going to tap in to more academic subject areas. You're going to be able to, you know, to come into their social skills, into, you know, just into their family life. So much more is going to be accessed than if we really just narrowly focus on these things that are very easy to record on a record sheet. And again, it's not that we don't want kids, you know, listening to story time, and it's not that we don't want them, you know, playing with numbers, but it's that we can use those even as tools to be helping them learn how to deal with frustration and learn how to deal with perfectionism and learn how to deal with their regulation, because academics are frustrating. And I think we do forget how frustrating they can be. that they are going to need these social emotional skills to get through this.
100%. So before we move on to takeaway number two, I have a question for you here. What advice would you give to teachers if they have families who are really focused on the academics, who are saying like, no, I want my kid to know their alphabet. I want them to leave here knowing how to write their name or whatever. Like, what advice would you give to teachers for responding to parents?
I mean, that is a tough one, because that becomes part of the parenting cultural shift that I work on, is trying to help parents identify what are the real skills. And I think that's part of it, is just sitting down with the parent and explaining why you're making the choices you're making, and explaining how spongy these kids are these days, you know, in those years, and that almost through like osmosis, they are going to pick up a lot of that just because they're in this beautiful, amazing environment, and because they have such a wonderful, caring, and supportive family that's clearly come in with, you know, very desired expectations. And I think it becomes, well, we're going to work on both, because I'm going to use academics to try to drive home a lot of these social emotional skills. And you're going to at home be reading to them a lot, and you're going to at home be focused on play. And together, this partnership is going to get this kid as far as they can go. But again, I think we have to push parents into understanding that childhood is not, you know, it's not a race. We can't be so focused on where the child is at five. We have to continue to be focused on where are they getting to for life. And I think it becomes having some hard conversations with families of saying, this is what I know as an educator is fundamentally best for supporting a child's growth. And it isn't sitting at a desk and learning how to write their name at this exact moment.
Now we are going to hear from Katie Crosby of Thriving Littles. Katie is an occupational therapist who specializes in supporting the whole family from the inside out, and her workshop is titled Can't or Won't? Investigating the Causes of Resistance.
The things that we want to teach kids, so we want to teach them skills, or we want to use our logical approaches often, and that's probably, you know, more regulated than going in and yelling or ripping the kid back and forcing them to go over and apologize, or, you know, using a really big, loud, scary voice, which when we adults go into our fight flight mode, we tend to be reactive and impulsive and act outside of our values in a way that really parallels with what kids are going through, you know, freeze or feel totally stuck, totally powerless with kids that are having a hard time. I think one thing that we learn working with so many different kids is that it can be super challenging and super intense. And the most dysregulated kids, or the kids that need us the most, often look the messiest and the most triggering in the moment. And being able to stay in connection with them through it in some form versus kind of demonize their behavior and shut down or be cold, detached, or go into fight mode and react, yell, threaten, shame, criticize. So that might sound something like, what's wrong with you? Or what were you thinking? Like, what's your problem? What were you doing? You're running and you knocked on the tower and are running away. Like, what is wrong with you? So the ways that we respond to them actually become how they're responding to themselves and their emotion, or the messy things inside. So they don't learn that, like, oh, I shouldn't do that behavior. You know, this person's yelling at me saying, what was wrong with you? They don't think, oh, okay, I shouldn't knock down towers. They learn that their emotion isn't okay, or their inner world doesn't make sense. Nobody will understand. And that when they have a hard time, adults disconnect from them, versus what we want them to learn, which is when you have a hard time, there are people that you can go to. And it's okay to be upset. It's not okay to hit down towers or harm things. But in the moment, when we respond to them, like you said, that higher point of the triangle, we're probably not going to get to in that immediate interaction. Their brain probably won't get there. So any way that we can, big takeaway from this point, I think, is build a we around these messy moments. And that can look messier or angstier than we think, but it's this assurance that, you know, maybe you point out what's happening, like, whoa, something's happening. This is a problem. You were building a tower and you ran by, knocked it over. Maybe it was an accident. Not the tower knocked down. Like, whoa, what's happening? Or like, oh, wow. Just pointing out and making a we through our interaction and through assuring kids that we aren't scared of them. We aren't shaming them. We aren't focused on who is right or who is wrong in that moment. We're really just pointing out the problem, building a we, and that is really responding to them versus reacting in the shamey or the criticizing way. So the ways that we are able to slow the moment enough to stay connected, stay in the room, and be together with a we can really help them realize that, okay, my brain is secure, I'm secure, we're here together, and we don't need to default to that reactivity because we feel secure at the core because there are people with us versus abandoning or isolating or all the things that really trigger our animal body, our nervous system, or in bigger ways. So it's such a practice. And I think using our own angst into something helpful to really, whoa, this is a problem. Sometimes my angsty voice comes up and kids feel that because it's an authentic, like, this is a big deal. This feels intense. You know, it's like, this is a problem, because when you name the intensity or name it, it's a way of responding versus reacting. And from there, maybe we get curious, like, wow, what happened? But it's less about tying it with a bow and needing to come to resolution in that moment of biggest intensity. It's really about getting that reactivity to simmer and help everybody feel secure enough to stay in the room and be there.
This podcast is sponsored by Active Skin Repair, a skin health company helping people heal with natural, non-toxic, medical-grade ingredients. Active Skin Repair uses a molecule called hypochlorous acid, which mimics our natural immune response to cleanse, soothe irritation, reduce inflammation, and support healing. We've been loving Active Skin Repair for all the cuts and scrapes that show up in the active toddler life. Sage loves that there's both the spray version, but also a cream version. He likes to get to choose which one he's going to do. He calls it the magic cream. And it's been so great for taking care of Mila's neck rash now that she's full on teething. Can we get a minute for a teething 3.5-month-old? What in the world? Active Skin Repair has thousands of 5-star reviews, and the ingredients so safe and clean, they can be used from the youngest member of the family to the oldest, keeping it simple with one soothing solution for all your family's skin health needs. Visit www.activeskinrepair.com to learn more about Active Skin Repair, and to get 20% off your order, use code VILLAGE. That's www.activeskinrepair.com, code VILLAGE for 20% off your order.
Hey there, I'm Debbie Reber, the founder of Tilt Parenting and the author of the book Differently Wired. The mission of Tilt is to change the way neurodivergence, whether that's having a learning disability, having ADHD, being gifted, autistic, or some combination of all of the above, is perceived and experienced so differently wired kids and the parents like us raising them can truly thrive. On the Tilt Parenting podcast, I get to talk with authors, therapists, educators, and parenting experts who are committed to this mission. I ask the questions my listeners are most curious about when it comes to supporting our kids. And in turn, my guests share strategies for challenges, out-of-the-box ideas for navigating school, best practices for therapies, tips for advocating, and so many thoughtful insights on what it really takes to help our kids grow up feeling seen and respected so they can create awesome lives for themselves. I know that raising a differently wired kid can feel overwhelming and isolating, but I promise you, you are not alone, and it can feel so much better. If you're on this parenting journey, come listen to Tilt Parenting. Together, we can shift this paradigm and show up for our exceptional kids with hope, possibility, and joy.
Next, we've got Mr. Chaz Lewis, consultant, parent coach, conscious discipline practitioner, podcaster, and content creator, giving us the inside scoop on using playful transitions in the classroom.
I always kind of remember when I first started my first year as a teacher, and the kids were coming in from outside to inside, and I was working as a Montessori teacher at the time. So I was working with a mixed age group of 3 to 5 years old. And they were coming inside, and I was just really repeating myself and just saying, wash your hands, sit at the table, wash your hands, sit at the table, wash your hands, sit at the table, wash your hands, sit at the table. And I was just saying that kind of over and over again. And then one of my higher ups, it wasn't even my boss, it was like my boss's boss, kind of took me to the side and said, you know, your voice sounds like, you know, like kind of harsh. Mm-hmm. And it was like, they said, maybe because your voice, you know, maybe it's just because you kind of have like a deeper voice and, you know, there's better ways to kind of transition them into what you want them to do. Mm-hmm. This is my first year and I'm like, well, like, you know, I'm still just trying to figure everything out myself. And I'm like, well, like, what else am I supposed to do? Like, I'm trying to like clearly communicate to them, because when I don't, they don't, you know, they're everywhere. And, you know, repeating myself has helped them kind of better go to where they're supposed to, remind them what they're supposed to do. And she had the idea of, she said, well, why don't you like do like a transition song or like sing to them or something like that? And, you know, first year, Mr. Chaz was like, okay, sing to them. Like, you really think that's going to make the difference? Like, mm-hmm. maybe a little out of touch, but sure, to appease you, I'll do it. Right. I didn't say all that to her face, but that was kind of my attitude. And so it might have been that afternoon or the next day, I was like, okay, let me sing, because she wants me to sing, so let me just sing. And so I just, and I was kind of, and honestly, because of the way I was perceiving it, I was kind of half doing it. And I was just like, wash your hands, sit down at the table. Wash your hands, sit down at the table. Wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands, sit down at the table. And so I did it. And like, as I was singing, they were kind of like looking at me, kind of like, well, this is new. But like, mysteriously, at least mysteriously to me at that moment, they started to do it. And where maybe I was repeating myself, out of the 20 kids I had, there would, you know, maybe be maybe five to eight of the 20 kids would actually do it. And when I sang the song, yeah. It was like 15 or 17 of the 20 kids would actually do it. And I was like, oh, snap, this actually worked.
Okay.
There's something to it. And then I kind of get more into it and, you know, went from like 15 to 17 to like 18 to 19. You know, there's always still that one kid who's distracted, who might need a little bit more right. One-on-one guidance and support. But it made it a lot easier to give that to that one child when most of the other children were actually following the instructions and the transition. That is when, for me, a huge light bulb went off. I was like, songs are really powerful. And I started to sing songs with everything. And now that is something that I'm kind of known for. In the internet space, but also even in the schools that I work with.
Nice.
I ended up years later, you know, becoming somewhat of a music teacher for, you know, entire school, and leading music for, you know, from infants to school agers, all in the same room, well, in the same gym. So it is a really powerful practice, and it's something that I highly recommend. If it's not something, you don't even have to you know, like, young kids don't really, you don't have to sing well. Right. I can't, you heard how I sing, like, I'm not a singer. You know, and you don't have to be even super intricate with, like, you don't have to be a songwriter Right. You know, just the wash your hands, sit down at the table. Yeah. Works wonders. And it's still something I do. Like, I just make it up off the spot a lot of times, and it's still effective.
Now we are going to hear from Clementine Foxglove, the founder and visionary behind Curious Parenting. Clem will be talking about how to manage a classroom of spitters and other challenging behaviors.
Yeah, it's not the information that he needs that hitting hurts. He knows that part. He needs to know, yeah, what else to do, what to do next, how else he can connect. Because that, yeah, I love that.
Yeah. And then when I watched him like resurface, there was also a part of me like spidey sense wise that was like, also those needs weren't met yet. So he's still going to try to meet those needs. So even though he just felt embarrassed and guilty and he hid, and now he's coming back out, we probably got about 5 minutes before we see this behavior again, because what he still needs are those sensory needs to be met. And he is looking for connection. And so I called him over and I was like, buddy, I'm trying to figure out how to make this thing work. I had like a little toy. And I was like, do you know how this works? I'm like, I'm going to fill a little bit of this connection bucket. And then when he came close, I just had my hand on him, on his back. And I was just kind of like rubbing his back, like get a little bit of sensory support in for him. And he ended up crawling into my lap and sitting in my lap, which is like perfect for him. I can give him some like deep pressure while he's there. I ended up like squeezing his legs, squeezing his arms while he was in my lap playing with this toy. And then as we were like playing with it, I said, wow, I noticed before it looked like you really wanted to play with her. And when you got close to her, I was wondering if you were thinking, how do I tell her I want to play? And you reached out and you grabbed her hair and you pushed her. And I want to help you figure out another way to do this. And he was just like, he didn't say anything. He just kind of like peered up on the side, like a little side eye action from my lap. And I was like, I wonder if you want to play with her. When your body gets close to her, if you could say, do you want to play? Or can I play too? And just like left it at that. I'm not going to make him go do it, but just like laying those foundations for him. But first meeting those needs immediately that I could meet, and then building this skill set of like, what's an acceptable, accessible alternative for him?
Yeah. And I think that's a really key point too, is making sure that we've met those needs that were underlying the behavior as much as we can before we do any kind of new skill building or discussion like that about what to do next time, because we want kids to be ready to receive the information. And if they are missing something that they really do need, it's going to be hard for them to hear us and internalize that for next time. So.
Yeah. And I think of like, if he was hungry, right? And that was the root, was that he was hungry. I wouldn't be like, we're not going to feed him until he learns the better way to do this. Right? Like, no, I'd feed him.
Yes.
And so like, similarly for me here, I'm like, these are also needs, and he can't really focus in on what to do next or how else to communicate this until those needs are met. And then his nervous system can calm, and then he can build this new skill. He can practice this new skill.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that.
One of the things you had said in one of your reels was that it's much easier to shift the behavior than to stop it. Can you break down what that means?
Yes. Yes. So yeah, trying to get, especially with certain things like, this is how to manage a classroom of spitters and hitting and kicking and all of those other things. Something like hitting, you can gently hold hands. You can put your body in between. There's not a lot you can do that, to stop screaming or spitting. And so that is really when the shifting is the most helpful, especially when you have a full classroom of kids who might be seeing your difficulty with what's happening, who might be similarly intrigued, who might like to join in with whatever's happening. And suddenly you have a bunch of kids screaming or a bunch of people, spitting. And so in my classroom, there was one time where everyone just for some reason got absolutely fascinated with spitting. And I was very grossed out by it. And we had already had many sicknesses. It was not time for more of these. And so, it was a lot of work for me to like what is going on here for me? Like, why is this such a strong reaction? And then how can I shift this without, making it seem like something you absolutely cannot do, because then we will have spit everywhere. And so, shifting the behavior. So we talked about it and we said, if you want to spit, you can always go spit in the sink, you know, which is something they're all used to doing because they, you know, with brushing teeth and things like that. Or if we all really need to spit, let's all go outside so we can all get our, like, get a spitting out. And so similarly with hitting or with screaming, like giving them another way either, you know, I've also stopped the car and being like, whoa, it's so loud in here. And that's really hard for me to drive. Let's stop and get all our screams out. And then if you're feeling frustrated, you could also join in and just, I mean, you can't always do that, but looking for those ways where we can shift that behavior. We can give kids another way to do what they're, you know, feeling like they need to do, whether that need is exploring screaming or expressing something with that or whatever they're doing.
Do you like what you heard today? Was it so helpful to get these little sneak peeks into the summit? Head on over to seedandsow.org/summit to register for our free Seed Teacher Summit and join us March 12th to the 14th for 18 incredible interviews, including full versions of what we shared today. Let's do this together, my friends.
Thanks for tuning in to Voices of Your Village. Check out the transcript at voicesofyourvillage.com. Did you know that we have a special community over on Instagram hanging out every day with more free content? Come join us at seed.and.sow, S-E-W. Take a screenshot of you tuning in, share it on the gram, and tag seed.and.sow to let me know your key takeaway. If you're digging this podcast, make sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. We love collaborating with you to raise emotionally intelligent humans.
Are you overwhelmed by the things that get in the way of you doing what you want to do? Are you looking for ways to simplify life to better align with your values? Do you want to create space in your schedule so you have room for more of the good stuff? Play, joy, relationships, gratitude, and more? If you answered yes to any of these questions, I invite you to check out Edit Your Life, a podcast to help you edit the unnecessary from your life so you have more room to enjoy the awesome. Through episodes with me, Christine Coe, and a range of super smart, compassionate, and thoughtful guests, you'll come away with big picture insights and practical ways to declutter your home, schedule, and mental space without getting bogged down by perfection. I have always believed that small moments and actions matter tremendously. My goal is to help you find agency and space in your life through doable baby steps that will leave you feeling accomplished instead of overwhelmed. Check out Edit Your Life wherever you enjoy your podcasts.